Today is, we have a new staff member joining our committee, and Representative Burnett is going to let us know about that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Julie Kirshner, our former staff person for the DFL caucus, did leave on January 23rd to go to Hennepin County Attorney's Office to do some work there, and we are welcoming Val Doslin, who currently works for the House caucus and does the research for the Education Policy Committee. So she's actually got a third hat for a third committee she's overseeing. I'd like to welcome Val.
All right. Thank you. The next item on our agenda will be the approval of the minutes from the February 10th committee hearing. Are there any additions or corrections to those minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Minutes are approved as distributed. The next item on our agenda will be House File 1901. Majority Leader Paulson is the chief author. Members, in your packet, you have the bill as well as an A1 amendment. At this time, I'd move House File 1901 to be heard before the committee, and at the same time, I'd also like to move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like to discuss. Are there any questions on the A1 amendment? Representative Burnett.
Madam Chair, I'm presuming that this amendment was offered because it would exempt the state of Minnesota from these procedures, which means there's probably going to be a big fiscal note. And I'm just wondering what the fiscal note would have been to the state of Minnesota had this amendment not been adopted.
Majority Leader Paulson.
Madam Chair and Representative Burnett, I'm sorry, the fiscal note has, I haven't had any discussions about that, so I just wanted to get the bill in the form of, the original presentation I had hoped to offer it without utilities being included.
Representative Burnett.
The article that was included in our packet does refer to the state of Minnesota in Minnesota Department of Transportation. It seems that's where the biggest problem is. And I'm just wondering why the state of Minnesota is being exempt from this procedure. If it's the state of Minnesota causing the problem, not offering the right property values to homeowners who take property, why exempt them?
Representative Burnett, it's my understanding that this section of law deals with the public utilities, the electric, gas, that I don't believe that it has to do with the state of Minnesota, maybe.
Madam Chair, as I just mentioned, that's correct.
So then I'm just trying to clarify the amendment because it does say the eminent powers exercised under Minnesota statute, so that's only for the public utilities?
Majority Leader Paulson.
Madam Chair, that is correct, and if you'd like, you can have counsel describe Section 222, but it's regards to utilities.
Chair,
Representative Burnett.
If that's the case, then there should be a fiscal note because this will cost Minnesota a lot more in condemning property. And I'm wondering why there's not a fiscal note on this particular amendment, on the bill, rather.
Representative Burnett, this bill will be going to Transportation Finance. There will be a fiscal note requested when it goes to Transportation Finance. Today in this committee, we're going to talk about the policies about eminent domain and the attorney's fees.
Okay.
But I assure you the issue of the costs associated with this policy initiative will be fully discussed as it moves through a number of committees.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any additional questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Representative Paulson, now that you have the bill in the shape that you'd like to discuss it, would you please present the bill to the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker and Madam Chair and members. Constitutionally, eminent domain should be used when it is absolutely necessary. We should be sure that when government takes property and is involved in the taking of property, the property owners are adequately compensated and that there are indeed very fair and proper procedures that are followed. And we are starting to see some examples where that could not be the case, or at least there are some questions being arisen as to whether we are using eminent domain properly. And so I think in the context of the bill before us, it's good to have a public policy discussion about that. The intent of the bill is to offer some balance so that the big power of government, in essence, can be very formidable. And this is to provide a little bit of support so that there are cases that move forward where we have a willing seller of property. We need to make sure that we treat citizens very fairly and adequate compensation, and we make sure that the playing field is indeed fair. And so the purpose of having attorney fees included as a part of, in terms of the practice of eminent domain, is a in instances of where there perhaps may be lowballing or not adequate compensation provided to property owners, there's a threshold here allowing for a judge to adequately ask for reasonable attorney fees to be applied and offered to someone who is being property is taken from. And Madam Chair, we have several witnesses, I think, who will go into the details of the bill based on previous history and experiences and can answer a lot of technical questions as well.
Right. Thank you, Majority Leader Paulson. I'm planning on spending about an hour on the bill here today. We have two more bills in front of the committee, and so I'm going to ask that you confine your remarks to no more than a total of a half hour to allow those who are in opposition to speak in time for questions from the committee as well. Welcome to the committee. If you state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Alyssa Shalander. I represent the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. I'm also working with a coalition of other small business groups, and we've sort of dubbed ourselves the Alliance for Reasonable Municipal Regulation. That group includes the Builders Association, the retailers, the realtors, petroleum marketers, Super America, and the Grocers Association. The reason that all of these small business groups are interested in bills such as this one is because our members have all sort of decided that the legislature needs to do more to protect the rights of property owners. As Representative Paulson explained, this bill sort of it does two things. First, it allows for a court to award attorney's fees to a property owner whose property is the subject of a condemnation proceeding. If that property owner is able to prove that their property is indeed worth more than 20% of what they were originally offered by the government for the property. This type of provision exists in the law of all our surrounding states. Wisconsin, Iowa, North and South Dakota, and Nebraska all have some type of provision like this. The reason that we're asking for this type of provision is not because we're trying to make attorneys rich, it's just it serves in these other states as a mechanism to even the bargaining power between, you know, this David and Goliath situation that we have when the government, who takes property all the time, who does this every day, and an individual property owner who, you know, may just be involved in a condemnation for the first time. The idea of having the sort of penalty of having to pay attorney's fees, we think serves as an incentive for the government to make an offer closer to fair market value right off the bat and to get the parties closer together. We think it serves as a disincentive to litigate and to go through a costly litigation, eminent domain proceeding. So that's the first part of the bill. The second part of the bill is, as Representative Paulson mentioned, what we're trying to do here is to get the legislature to think about scaling back when eminent domain can be used. And I'm sure many of you are aware, in 2001, two of our dealerships were condemned by the city of Richfield so that the city of Richfield could turn that property over to the Best Buy Corporation. They used eminent domain to do that. And, of course, our dealerships, you know, they fought that, and they fought against the idea of a government coming in to favor one business for another private business. Unfortunately, the dealers lost, and the Best Buy corporate headquarters now sits on that piece of property. And, I just remind the committee of this particular situation, not because, you know, we're here for some sort of revenge because this bill can't do anything to affect those property owners at this point, but it just, I think, is a good example of, you know, here we had a property owner who's a very sophisticated landowner. This is someone who's running 15 dealerships, who buys and sells property all the time, who had the resources to fight and to put into making sure that his rights were protected as a property owner, and still came away from the proceedings feeling that the law is very unfair to a property owner who's in this situation. So if in the best possible situation where you've got a property owner like the one I represent who's really feeling that the law is, that the deck is sort of stacked against a property owner during a condemnation proceeding, you know, you think about that in the context of a homeowner or a, you know, a real small business person who really doesn't have the resources to go through a proceeding that's costly and time consuming. And so, you know, what our membership did is we just, you know, we looked at what the Walzers went through in Richfield and the end results, and they just thought that maybe we should be using our voice at the Capitol to try to get the legislature to make this area of the law a little more fair to property owners. So that's why car dealers care. But with me today is John Schmick, and John is someone that I just met working on this bill. He is a professional land appraiser and has some very strong opinions about how Minnesota's law should be changed. So I'll let John talk about the attorney's fees portion of the bill.
If I might, Representative Pugh has a question for you.
Thank
first.
You.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, and I'll start by saying I'm sympathetic to your position and generally supportive, but what I'm concerned with is the language that you employ on page 2. We talk about there'd have to be a showing that it serves a primarily public purpose. How will we define that, or what?
Ms. Schlander.
Madam Chair, Representative Pugh. First, let me preface my comments by saying I fully intended to have a real live lawyer here today who could really answer that question. But what I have been told by those practitioners who actually practice in this area is that the reason we crafted this language in this way is because what we're trying to do is get the legislature to signal to the court that we would like the reins to be pulled in a little bit. We didn't want to create a definition of public purpose. We didn't want to create a laundry list of roads are okay, bridges are okay, you know, schools are okay, but you can't use it for this, and this purpose, because we'll be here every single year amending that for somebody's, you know, unique situation. So the practitioners feel that adding the word primarily, you know, to serve a primarily a public purpose will serve the purpose of pulling the reins. Right now the court has pretty much said that they give great deference to whatever government taking entity is doing the taking, because the law is just so broad right now that they're very lenient to allow just about any justification for a public purpose when it comes to a taking. So I don't know if there are real lawyers in the audience that maybe want to add.
There's more lawyers in this room than you want to count it. But we're not going to go there. So.
Madam Chair, if I could follow up, perhaps in getting at the intention of the bill and the author and supporters, would it be your intention that if in fact this law was in place at the time that Richfield attempted to take or started the proceeding against Walzer and McCarthy, would it be your intention that the court should have been able to stop the condemnation based on the statute, that in fact Best Buy would not have served primarily a public purpose in Richfield?
Ms. Schlander?
Madam Chair, Representative Pugh, yes, I think that's what we're trying to get at.
Thank you.
Any additional questions at this time? Representative Littman?
Well, to that point, because I likewise share Representative Pugh's concern about the language, and although I support Representative Paulson in the direction that you're trying to get at, I'm just wondering why Richfield couldn't argue that gleaming office towers were a more important public purpose or part of community identity than perhaps Walzer Chevrolet or a parking lot, you know, full of automobiles. That sent a different message to those folks driving by on 494 about what Richfield was all about, and that was really their public purpose as opposed to who owned it. Why wouldn't you imagine that argument wouldn't be successful? Mindful, of course, that you're not practicing in front of the condemnation commissioners, but I guess I'm just wondering, can you give me some assessment about whether the language that you've chosen, primarily public purpose, would actually meet the needs that we both agree with? Any suggestions? Oh, Mr. Grooms.
Can we have a...
We allow people to phone a friend in this committee, yeah. So it looks like Mr. Grooms is going to be your friend today.
Is he a real-life lawyer?
I think he is. We're not counting him today. Mr. Grooms, if you'll state your name for the tape and attempt to answer Representative Lippman's concerns.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Lloyd Grooms. I'm an attorney with the law firm Winthrop & Weinstein. Madam Chair, Representative Lippman, to try to answer your question and maybe in doing so elaborate on the response to Representative Pugh, I think that there isn't necessarily that, if you will, the City of Richfield could not have proceeded with the condemnation under the argument that you proceeded, though it does present the argument allowing for the property owner to raise the question of, was this in fact just merely a shift from one private entity to another private entity, and that was the primary purpose for the condemnation, as opposed to a larger public purpose, one which I think you were alluded to, which may be a increase in the tax base or increased employment. But it puts it squarely to the court to have the ability to make that assessment on the evidence presented by the condemning authority.
Representative Lippman.
Two brief but related, quick follow-ups on those points, Madam Chairman, Mr. Grooms. What you're buying here is a fighting chance, A, would be my first question, and two, why not language along the lines of not only preponderance of the evidence standard, but also that the government entity has to take title?
Mr. Grooms.
So that you don't have these private owner to private owner transfers inspired by government.
Mr. Grooms.
Madam Chair, Representative Lippman, yes, I would appreciate at least having a fighting chance going into court, and I think this may give us more than simply a fighting chance. Number two, as to your other question, I think in terms of taking title, it could be the same way as I should argue in terms of more traditional real estate law, where the public entity simply becomes a straw man. So it does take title for some period of time only to convey out to the private entity. If you were going to say to completely retain title, that may be another approach to this issue. Again, I think what we're trying to do was add some fairness, not necessarily deprive public entities from their ability to still go forward with condemnation.
Thanks.
Right. Thank you. I think we'd like to continue with the testimony with Mr. Schmick first, and so we stay on our time schedule. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the tape, please.
My name is John Schmick. I'm a fee appraiser. I work in Minneapolis. I've been appraising for 18 years, and I'd like it known that I'm not here representing anybody. I'm not here representing my employer. I'm not here representing appraisers or property owners. I'm here because I've been fighting for a change in the law for the past 4 or 5 years based on what I've seen in my experience. And right now the law is broken and people are getting hurt financially. And this has been an issue that Attorney General Warren Spanis in 1974 wrote into a court decision that lays the responsibility for fixing this squarely on the legislators' shoulders. Now, the state's known that this needs to be fixed for 30 years and we're still here fighting for it. So I am a bit frustrated with the way the current law is going. Now, I've testified before a few committees in the past few years, and I can tell you about the autistic school that was offered $2,000 and the commissioners awarded $110,000, and yet they had to pay $30,000 in land planners, attorney's fees, and appraisal fees to get a fair award. I could tell you about a truck stop where the state offered $20,000, showed up at the commission hearing with an appraisal for $400,000, and the commission finally awarded $1.5 million. And they went through tens of thousands of dollars to defend themselves in that case. I could tell you about the church that lost 30% of their parking, and because of that, they lost 30% of their parishioners, affecting their budgets and affecting their ability to stay on their property. I could tell you about the case in St. Cloud, where the county got an appraisal and then took the position that because they had it in writing, they didn't have the ability to negotiate. They could only go within 5% of the appraised value and force the client into court simply because they felt they had to be told by a court to offer a fair value. I mean, the examples go on and on and on. What I've seen over 18 years is that this is a one-sided system, and it's all on the part of the condemning owners. They've got, when you talk about MnDOT, they've got the state attorney general's office representing them. They've got their engineers representing them. They've got all the in-house expertise that they need. They just have to go out and get an appraisal. to present their side of the court, their side of the argument. The property owner, on the other hand, has to go out and hire the attorney, hire the appraiser. If a land planner is needed, he's got to hire all of his experts. Now, the point of eminent domain, which a lot of government entities seem to think, is to buy it at the cheapest price. That's not their responsibility. Their responsibility is to make the property owner whole and not to inflict thousands and thousands of dollars of economic harm on them simply because they want to be treated fairly. And that's what's happening. If they say no to the offer, they are punished by being pushed into court and having to represent, having to hire all this representation to defend themselves. So even if they win their argument, they're still out thousands of dollars trying to defend themselves. Now, market value is supposed to be based on a willing buyer and willing seller. That's not what you have here. Eminent domain, the essence of eminent domain is we want it, and we're going to take it, and we're going to sue you to get it. Now, why should the property owner be put out thousands of dollars to defend himself in that kind of a system? Because that's what the system is today. I think one of the other representative up here indicated that all the five states around us have some kind of a law in place that allow reimbursement of attorney's fees. North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Iowa, and Wisconsin. Minnesota is the only state in this region that doesn't do this. We're not even on the cutting edge. We're not even playing catch-up. We're still stuck 30 years ago. It wasn't until this last summer that a law was changed where the condemning authority was required to turn over their appraisal when they made the offer. That's the first time in my 18 years that a property owner has even known the basis for what the offer was made. And it's those kinds of situations where they can look at the appraisal and say, well, maybe you got the wrong square footage. Maybe you got the wrong building height. Let's find out where there are errors, correct them, and sit down and negotiate. It was a good first step. But the problem still exists that there's no reimbursement for the property owners. The autistic school had to hire a land planner just to redevelop a traffic pattern on their site to deal with the taking. None of that was reimbursed. I mean, the examples just go on and on. You are not going to fix the problems in this system until you put a level playing field in place. And the only way you're going to get a level playing field is that both sides have something at risk. Right now, the condemning authorities have nothing at risk. If they, for whatever reason, put in an offer that's too low and they lose in court, fine. They just have to pay what the commissioners and the court determine is fair market value. The property owner, even if he wins, is still out thousands and thousands of dollars. You create a situation where you create an incentive for the state to go to court. They know how expensive it is. They use it as a weapon to try to get a settlement, to force settlements. And that's what has become a weapon. And that's not the way the system was supposed to work. You're supposed to make the property owners whole. Now, if they had to go out in the marketplace, willing buyer, willing seller, most of these offers that are rejected, they'd never get the property. I'm working with a client right now who took our appraisals and said, you know, we're going to save some money by not going to court, so we're going to bump these offers 15%. In 3 days, they had half the people signed up to settle. It can work, but not if you're going to abuse the system and use it like a weapon.
Mr. Schmick, are you about done with your comments in order for me to allow time for the other people testifying?
Yes, I am. This is a good first step. It needs to be done. The responsibility rests with you folks, and it should be a campaign issue. I mean, every one of you should ask yourselves, because this affects you. If your home was taken, you'd be in the same boat. Would any one of you want to go back to your constituents and say, I think it's okay for the government to economically harm you when we take your property? That's not a question I'd want to answer for a constituent. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Schmick? Thank you. Majority Leader Paulson, I have Brad Gunn and Lloyd Brooms.
They had complex today, Madam Chair.
Okay. So, in other words, you're done as far as your testimony and support. Are there any questions for the bill author at this time before we go into opposition testimony? Mr. Hickey?
Madam Chair, I did want to make a few brief comments. I don't know if I was on your list or not.
You were not on my list, but we will let you make a few brief comments.
I called.
I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it's okay. Thanks for the opportunity. Certainly no expert on eminent domain, but Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business, and I appreciate the chance to make a few brief comments here today. First of all, I want to thank Representative Paulson and the auto dealers for bringing this forward. Somewhere, members, this all changed, and that's where clearly I'm no expert. I don't know what year, what case that we got into the business in a big way of taking private property to favor another private property. And I think that's the shocking thing that people are kind of catching up with. That really brought it home to us through the Walzer case. But I think we can all find some examples if we think back of things we've seen in our community. There was activity in Minneapolis on the Nicollet Mall, and it's hit the NFIB board level. One of our board members in Rosemont has tremendous fears he's going to be uprooted. A long-standing good citizen of that community who's owned his property for many years, and he's afraid he's going to be uprooted in an eminent domain process simply to favor a different type of private property over his. And matter of fact, he owns a hardware store, a very nice hardware store. I think it provides a real service to the community, and I think most of you would conclude. But that is potentially what's brewing down in that city. Uproot a long time, good citizen in the community who provides valuable service for some other favored private property. And so I don't know what point that happened, but it's happened in a big way in this state. And that's why we really applaud Representative Paulson for trying to make a course correction on that. Additionally, I think the attorney fee provision is going to be very helpful to small businesses who can really suffer severe financial strain trying to come up with the type of money they need to put a good defense up under our current law. And I'm sure there are scores of examples where they just don't do that, and they just don't even get close to just compensation because of that. So anyways, I appreciate the time, and I strongly urge you to support Representative Paulson's bill.
Thank you. And Mr. Hickey, I'm sorry, Mr. Reardon tells me you did call, but you didn't actually get on the written list, so our apologies for that. I have a brief question for you. It's always a matter of balance, different rights and competing interests. The way the bill is written currently, the only party that is allowed to recover costs is the property owner. If you had a property owner that was unreasonable and was in the process of dragging the public entity through the mud, if you would you support an amendment to this bill that would allow for the public entities to recover costs in a balancing act with this bill?
Madam Chair, that's a very good question, and I would need some time to think about it. Clearly, you're maybe concerned about a holdout situation where most property owners have agreed, but possibly one last one.
Mr. Hickey, I'm concerned about balance, and this can work both ways. And certainly we don't want, you know, big government taking advantage of little poor property owner. But in turn, if there is a true public purpose, we need a road to go through, we need whatever, and we have an obstinate property owner that causes a city or a county or the state to incur large costs and a long protracted process. Would you see it as being fair that the bill reflect ability for the public entity to recover as well?
I think that's a situation we'll have to look into as this bill moves on.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Slander.
I just wanted to add to that. You know, we have discussed this particular suggestion, and we think this is only fair. What's sort of good for the goose is good for the gander, and we think that having sort of a quid pro quo approach with respect to attorney's fees, I think, is just a fine thing. Actually, Representative Queasley had a situation in his district where the property owner was he fought a long time, ended up being awarded less than what he was originally offered, and ended up having to pay the government back the difference. And of course, in that situation, we think, you know, there may have been some frivolousness going on, and I think making that person pay for attorney's fees would be a fair thing to do.
All right, thank you. Representative Lippman.
Well, I guess my observation was that the difference between plaintiffs and defendants, which is the defendant could, you know, I assume could offer an offer of judgment, which is I'll be glad to pay you this amount if you take this deal today or or within a short period of time, and if they don't get more than that, then at least the I think the expert witness fees and other kind of costs, taxable costs, would be charged to the plaintiff. Now, that's not attorney's fees, but at least a partial solution I think exists now, in that if there was unreasonableness on the plaintiff's side, an offer of judgment could say, well, we could end this today. And there is some sort of cost shifting there. So I guess, but I would just add to that point is that there are current mechanisms for part of that. I think it's the rare case that Mr. Queasley talks about. I think most of these property owners that I know are eager for some sort of reasonable settlement.
Okay, thank you. Majority Leader Paulson, is there anything that you'd like to add before we go to the opposition testimony?
Madam Chair, may I have one moment?
Certainly.
Madam Chairman, thank you. I did call Mr. Bearden, but did not tell him that I wanted to be on the witness list. My apologies, and I would like to take a moment. My name is Jim Erickson. I represent the Business Owners Group. As Representative Lippman knows, a number of his constituents, businesses, residences, property owners, are in the crosshairs of Minnesota Department of Transportation with respect to improvements on Highway 36 in connection with the Stillwater Bridge, something that's a well-known opportunity that is now going on. With me is Mr. Don Broman, and since we won't take any more time, I want to just make it clear that probably this, if you thought Rochester was brutal, and Rochester is much the poster child for why we're here. Much of the legislation that you considered last year and passed, you did some things. This legislature moved from $500 to $1,500 the amount of reimbursement for an appraisal cost that a landowner could get. Still nowhere near adequate, but it was an attempt to do so. You did other things last year. There are other bills in this legislature, represented by others, Representative Queasley. We support Representative Paulson's bill, but I'm here representing a group of people who are very concerned, reading the newspaper stories last fall about the Rochester, and I think it's fair to say, fiasco. There's one number that jumps out. The original total of this estimated cost of property acquisition in the Rochester Highway 52 improvement is $32 million. The number now being paid is $82 million and counting. And so my clients, who sit, who Mr. Broman and our group represents, sit and listen to that and look at that kind of a number and listen to the testimony of this very articulate appraiser here today and are scared to death. We certainly do not want to be in the path of progress. We certainly do not oppose the Stillwater Bridge if, in fact, it should be built and where it should be built. But we certainly say, and the Stillwater Chamber of Commerce is strongly on record saying, until the owners and the property owners and the businesses and the residents' concerns are addressed, and the balance between the condemning authority and the landowner, who is simply being asked to be a contributor, but not an unfair contributor to the public good, is redressed, we want to say, stop. Let's fix the problem. And we certainly support Representative Paulson. I actually could take some time on from the opponents to say we oppose this bill because it doesn't go far enough, and it certainly doesn't. So I want to be on the record to say that we'll be back in front of you in all these committees. It is a matter, as you Representative Bernad raised, about cost. But the cost, if it costs more to build that bridge and improve the and take those businesses to improve the public, the burden ought not to fall on the people who are being involuntarily condemned. And we'll look forward to working with you this session and next session and next session to continue to redress that balance on behalf of that group of and all property owners. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson. Next, we'll move to those that would like to speak in opposition to this bill. First on the list is Roger Knutson, speaking on behalf of the Minnesota League of Cities. I don't know if Ms. Finn is going to join him or not. And in the interest of full disclosure, Mr. Knutson is the city attorney for the city of Lakeville. It's always fun when the opposition brings in the hometown team.
It's good to be here.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Knutson, if you'd state your name for the record.
Roger Knutson, representing, I'm here with the League of Cities, and Mr. Erickson from the city of Lakeville said I should also say I am here on behalf of the city of Lakeville.
Nice to know. Ms. Finn.
Madam Chair, my name is Ann Finn. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities, and I don't have many comments today. I just wanted to get our opposition to the bill on the record, and I think that Mr. Knudsen will tell you in his testimony that the provisions in this bill may have some very broad and possibly unintended complications regarding economic development and building roads. So with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Knudsen, and when he's finished, we will stand for questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Knudsen.
Thank you. I'm here today representing not big government, but little government. And I'm going to suggest there are a lot more little governments out there than there are big governments. You've heard a lot of anecdotal evidence today about large projects like the Walter Project in Richfield, and I'm here, I've been doing this for 30 years, and I have never come anywhere near anything like the Walter Project or anything of that magnitude. And I think one of the things this bill does is lose track of the fact of what's really happening in the condemnation area. Most of the things that happen in condemnation never make the newspapers. Only a very few do, the big ones. The vast majority of cases that we're involved in are very small indeed. There are strip takes for roads, for sewer pipes, for storm sewer pipes, for ponds. They're very little projects. Trails is a common one. And the typical award is not millions of dollars, it's hundreds or maybe $1,000. And with that in mind, I'm going to just talk a minute about attorney's fees. When we go and get an appraisal, you would have the impression from listening to the previous witnesses that someone is telling this appraiser to lowball something. If people are doing that, I'm not saying they aren't. I am not aware of it, and I have never heard any, I have never instructed an appraiser to give me a lowball. I have never heard another government lawyer ever suggesting that's the case, and I can assure you, no member of the city council has ever told me we want a lowball so we can get a good deal for the government. No one ever has ever given me those instructions, and I have never done that. When we get we go out for an appraisal, I say I want an honest appraisal. You know, maybe that's not credible, but those of you speak to the city attorneys where you reside, and I think that's, you'll find the majority of the cases is true. The vast majority of the cases, we're just not in that business. You had one appraiser just testify how he feels the other appraisers are not doing a good job. Well, when I go, I try to find the best appraiser I can and go with that information, since I have no personal knowledge or expertise in land values. I have to rely on an appraiser, and when I get that appraised value, I offer it to someone. Now, with that in mind, the attorney's fees provision, just briefly. What that is going to do is change the negotiating the playing field substantially. If on a typical one, I just had one last year in the city of Chanhassen, where I think we acquired 50 small strips through a trail. Each of the landowners, and we worked, I think, all of them out, or most of them out, got a few $1,000. But if I get an appraisal that says it's worth $1,000, and it's an honest appraisal, and it's the best opinion I can possibly muster from an appraiser, it's worth $1,000. I can absolutely assure you the landowner can find someone that's worth more. And they'll keep looking until they will. And I have no problem with that. They do that, and that's fine. But when they get that appraisal for $1,300, and I've offered $1,000, if we proceed, I have to factor in, I'm going to have to pay this guy attorney's fees if he can talk the commissioners into paying an extra $200. He's going to put a leverage on the government to pay more than what the property is worth. Maybe that doesn't work in the Walter cases where you're dealing with millions of dollars, but most of your condemnation cases are not anywhere near that. They're in the hundreds and the thousands for most of the condemnation cases, which are strip takes. It changes the playing field in an unfair way to the government and therefore to the citizens who have to pay the bill. You just last year adopted a new bill that requires us to give the appraisal, give $1,500 for an appraisal and provide that to the landowner. And once he has that appraisal, then we should negotiate. But now, with this bill here, you're going to handcuff us. As soon as I say, yeah, I'm willing to pay you more, I got to think, oh, ho, as soon as I pay you the extra $200, I also have to pay your attorney's fees. So what is the net result of that is going to be?
probably more litigation, not less. You're going to encourage people who think they can get it up 20% to go for it, the extra couple hundred bucks, and you're going to have a lot more cases going to commissioner's hearing and a lot more cases going to jury trials. So I think it creates more of a problem than any perceived problem that it solves. That's the problem. But the biggest problem with this bill, in my judgment, I don't want to comment on it. It's first, proved by preponderance of the evidence. Right now, by case law from the Minnesota Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court going back not a few years, but decades, there's deference due to the government in making that decision as to what a public purpose is. The United States Supreme Court in particular has said, we will not substitute our judgment for a legislative judgment as to what constitutes a public purpose. That's based upon separation of powers, that the legislative body, the city councils, the county commissioners should be making those initial judgments. And those judgments should be reviewed by the courts for palpable injustice. You're turning that case law on its head. And you're asking judges to make those decisions rather than city council members. And I think that is very, very inappropriate. I think the system we have now works well. The real thing, and you asked, I think Representative Pugh or someone asked the question, primarily a public purpose, that provision in there. What does that mean? I don't know what it means. I know where it comes from. It comes from one of the Walter Tiff cases where they applied it in different circumstances. And they said this test does not apply in the eminent domain procedure. What is a judge to do with this? On the one hand, the government wants to condemn the property for this purpose, and he has purposes 1 through 5. Someone, a private property owner, will be benefited. How is a judge supposed to weigh those things? You've given them no standard, so you're going to have judges sitting up there saying, well, you know, in my judgment, the fact that someone's going to get money is more important than the fact that that the blight will be eliminated for the community. This will have several effects, immediate effects. First, it'll have a chilling effect on the government trying to solve lots of problems, redevelopment problems. If you want to stop redevelopment, if you want to stop all that, then it could have that effect. Second, and for sure, no question about it, you will have lots and lots of very expensive litigation trying to figure out what that phrase means. Because I don't know what it means. I'll give one quick example, and I know your time is precious. We recently, in the city of Lakeville, had a situation where a developer came in and wanted to put in a subdivision. He needed, I forget the exact length, 200-300 feet of an easement through private property to put in a sanitary sewer pipe. Is that a primary public benefit? The subdivider is going to make money on the homes, I assume. We hope so anyway, and we have no issue with that. That's fine. What is the public benefit to provide sewer to this private property? Would that survive the primarily public purpose? I don't know. We had another situation, and it's a common situation where someone comes in and wants to put up, I'll just say, a Target store. And you need two left turn lanes. If you can't work a deal, and we have to condemn the property for those two left turn lanes. What is the primary public purpose? Is it primarily a public purpose, or is it for Target, or is it for community development, or what is it? And you're just throwing this in the hands of a judge and say, what do you think? And then, the real hooker, one of the real hookers in this, if we get it wrong, and as a city attorney, they're going to ask me, well, what about those turn lanes? What do you think? Well, I don't know. Let's go for it. If I get it wrong, we're going to pay. We're going to pay Mr. Gunn's or Mr. Groom's attorney's fees. And they don't, and fortunately for them, they don't make the same kind of hourly rates as city attorneys make. They make 3 times as much. So we're going to pay through the nose, which is fine. But we're left in absolute limbo, and I think it's going to change the landscape of what cities can legitimately do. And I would hope, just because of your concerns of a few projects, and I'm not
not going to deny that there are some abuses, that you are going to slam the door for all sorts of good things that are happening in the state of Minnesota based upon a few anecdotes. Thank you. With that, I'd stand for any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Knutson. Representative Coles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Knutson, I'd like to go back to your earlier testimony about attorney's fees, because I'm not sure I understood it as it relates to the bill as I think I'm reading the bill. You said that if there's an appraisal or an offer made by a city for $1,000 and the property owner is looking for $1,300 and you decide to settle for $1,200, that you have to pay attorney's fees as well. As I read the bill, that requirement to pay attorney's fees, I think, unless I'm wrong, and I certainly could be wrong, but that requirement to pay attorney's fees doesn't kick in unless the court determines that you have to pay $1,200, that the fair market value for the property is $1,200. So if the city settles with the landowner, you don't have to pay the attorney's fees. Am I reading the bill incorrectly?
Well, I will say you're reading it differently than I am. And maybe a court would have to figure out which of us is reading it right. And if I ever have to argue it, I'll take your position. But that's not how I read it. First, when we do this, we'll end up with a final certificate, a final judgment after the offer. So we will have a final judgment over 20% or 21% more than our initial offer, and as determined at any level in the eminent domain proceeding. So I think, yes, we would have paid the attorney's fees. And that's another critical thing here. Based on your initial offer, that means when you call up and I offered you the $1,000 and you call back and say, I have an appraisal that says $1,500, we'll take $1,500, and I say yes. As soon as I say yes, I owe you the attorney's fees. That's what it says in my judgment.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure that is what the bill says, but I could be wrong, I guess. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Representative Lippman.
Well, on a similar vein, I'm going to try it. It's my understanding, Madam Chairman, Mr. Knutson, of how this works in Wisconsin across the border, where they have a regimen like this, which is if you say 1,000 and the landowner says, well, the settlement offer is 1,300, you say, okay, but I'm not going to pay the fees. It's just 1,300 straight. Why would that kind of arrangement be prohibited under this bill, if you can point me to it?
Mr. Peterson.
I don't think it would be prohibited. That is possibly one of the results of the negotiations. On the other hand, he could have a solid, I could look at his appraisal, for example, and say, I got my honest appraisal, and it says 1,000. I look at yours, and you convince me it's 1,200, right?
Right.
Then he says, I want my attorney's fees. Are we going to hearing?
And
then we go to a hearing, and it's 1,200, and I have to pay his attorney's fees.
Representative Lippman.
Madam Chairman and Mr. Knutson, it's my experience, in the practice of law, that the attorney's fees are the first things negotiated away, basically, if you were to say, see in court, there are very few clients who are going to just litigate over the fee question. They're going to figure out some other way, either particularly by drilling down on us, or by taking it themselves. They're not likely to go through the expense of the hearing for just the fee portion. But let me move on just very briefly. Is it your view that a 20% margin of error is too tight for local units of government?
Absolutely.
Mr. Knutson.
Can you tell me why?
Mr. Knutson.
I have seen, again, there seems to be a presumption by someone that the appraisal I'm getting is nonsense and the appraisal that the landowner is getting is gospel. Well, that, if you can send me to the gospel writers, I will hire them. But I don't think that's the case. It is not uncommon to see, get my appraisal, I won't say a number, it doesn't matter what it is, and get the other side to 10 times that. And then I have to go to a commissioner's hearing, and then I potentially have a jury trial. And you say, what is the real market value? Well, it isn't chipped in stone someplace. We can uncover it. It's whatever commissioners ultimately say or a jury ultimately says. And even though I think my number is right, and even after the jury's in, I think my number is right, sometimes you get it wrong by according to the jury.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Knutson, first for the record, let me indicate Mr. Knutson's firm, I believe, still represents the city of St. Louis Park.
That's correct.
Mr. Knutson.
So, Mr. Knutson, I guess I have a question regarding the two scenarios that you posited as being much more common than the Walzer kind of situation. If you need land for 300 feet to put in a sanitary sewer for a big new private development, which I would expect couldn't take place without making a sanitary sewer connection, does not that put the owner of the land that you need for the sewer in a position to strangle the entire redevelopment, in essence, to get more than a fair amount of value, maybe to extort the government or the private property that's going to be developing across the street, if you will?
Mr. Knutson.
Absolutely. I mean, but for the power of condemnation. And most of the time, just having that power makes people act more responsibly because they can't extort or can't leverage us. But in that particular situation, and in the situation I mentioned, it got worked out. We didn't have to go through the condemnation process. But for the power of condemnation, I know that owner, and they're good folks, but they like their money as well as anyone else. If he could say, you can't have, let's see the situation. There's 100 units of housing you're going to put in here. You need, I don't know, a quarter acre of my land, to strip through my land for your pipe. Let me see, what is that worth to you? Oh, maybe $1,000 a foot? I mean, because it's not the value of the land anymore, it's the value of what, you can't use your land without this little strip. It creates an incredible situation for that developer to be.
Representative Lass?
Madam Chair, thank you. Follow-up, your other example had to do with the issue of putting in two left turn lanes to facilitate a commercial redevelopment. Wouldn't the scenario you posited created an environment in which the city government considering condemning property might be choosing between fighting in court over enough property to add two left turn lanes versus deciding not to do that, but let the development go through anyway and creating an incredible traffic congestion, which might impair the ability of the development to be successful as well as to create a lot of inconvenience for anyone driving in that area?
Again, absolutely. And I can bring you around the Twin Cities where they didn't put in the two turn lanes, we only got some, tried to get around and it's a mess. And that's a real life situation, putting in those turn lanes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Knutson. I think we'll move on in the matter of time we have left. Dan Clint from Anoka County Attorney's Office. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Clint, if you'll state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dan Clint. I'm an assistant Anoka County attorney. I've been with the county attorney's office for almost 20 years now, and 18 years of that has been in the area of eminent domain. Almost half my time has been there. And I've been asked to testify in this bill for a number of reasons, and I want to address two issues. The first issue has to do with the primarily public purpose, and then the second issue is the attorney's fees. In my view, the primarily public purpose language is flawed. It's included in 117. Minnesota Statute 117, the condemnation law, is mostly a process statute. If this is to try to preclude the Walzers and those types of things, what you should be looking at is changing the ability of those types of entities to condemn for those things, an EDA or an HRA. Here, instead of dealing with the issue head on, you're putting it into the lap of a judge to decide what is a primarily public purpose. That's going to be litigated every time and get different answers in different district courts, and maybe different answers in the same district court by different judges. If that's the primary purpose of this, is to limit those situations, limit the ability of cities, HRAs, or other development entities to acquire private land and turn it over to another developer, it should be addressed in their ability and authority to use eminent domain. Minnesota Statute Section 117 does not give any entity the ability to use eminent domain. It has to be authorized by statute, or a county or a state has that inherent ability under the Constitution. Given that comment, I want to address the attorney's fees issue, because that actually affects the counties more than the primarily public purpose, because there's not a lot of counties specifically acquiring private property to turn over to developments, to developers. That's primarily in the cities. I want to address one issue that seems to be floating out there, and that is that the condemning authority is out there to try to get the best deal possible, that they're out there to try to lowball the landowner. In my 18 years at the county and my other involvement in other cities and working with them on joint powers agreement where we jointly acquired property, that's not the approach that we take. It's not the approach that I've seen taken. The idea is you hire an appraiser, you don't give him directions to come in low, you don't give him directions to come in high. You give him an assignment to appraise the property. There's no intention to lowball. The important thing to also remember is that this is a process. When we have a project, a mile-long road, we could have 30 or 40 parcels that have to be appraised. We do that 6 months to a year in advance before the offers are even made. Land values can change from that time forward, and you're doing a number of appraisals. If you then use those for negotiation and a landowner comes in with something that's over 20%, because at the time you did your appraisal you may have missed something, or it was not evident in how the taking affects the property, you're going to end up having attorney's fees. For every horror story that is told by landowners, I can tell you horror stories that I've faced in terms of demands by landowners. I recently had a trial, a simple strip taking off of a single family house. Our appraisal was at $23,000. The commission, they wanted $144,000. The commissioners awarded $29,000. We went to trial for a week. The jury returned a verdict of $31,000. I tried settling in the middle of the trial, but the attorney already had $45,000 into the case. What is reasonable? Heck, if the attorney is advocating for a client, it's difficult to determine what is reasonable. But the most important thing is that when we go out and negotiate, it's not an attorney from the county representing the county. It's our right-of-way agent. Minnesota Statute 117 set up an informal process. You get an appraisal, you negotiate. If you have to, then you go to the landowner and get his own appraisal. You increase the value of that appraisal to $1,500. Most single-family and strip takings that are involved, most condemnations that we're involved with, you can get an appraisal for $1,500. Most condemnation actions are not the Walzer types, the big ones, as the previous speaker said. They're small strip takings to widen a road, acquiring 27 feet, 16 feet. And to think that the Walzers of the world are in the MnDOT problem in Rochester is the norm, I think is wrong. The norm is that 80% of our acquisitions are done through direct purchase as part of the condemnation. The other 20% go to commissioner's hearing. Out of that 20%, less than 1% ends up going to trial. 20% difference in values is really pretty small, especially when you're dealing with strip takings. But often you have severance damages. What's the value or the diminished value of the house if you're now 27 feet closer than before? And an appraiser might say 5, another might say 7, another might say 10% diminution in value. It's an art form. It's not a science. and if you're going to impose attorney's fees on a 20% difference, I predict that almost everything will go to a commissioner's hearing and then appealed to a trial level if that 20% isn't reached. I know you wanted to be done by 3:30. I see the time is running out. And I know that there's at least one other individual that wants to testify in opposition to this. So,
right. Thank you, Mr. Clint. Are there any, was your question for Mr. Clint?
If I could.
Yes, certainly. Representative Whitman.
Chairman Holberg, Mr. Clint, taking on the hypothetical, let's say for Anoka, there's a development the city of Anoka wants to do or the county wants to do along Main Street, and I represent perhaps a Chinese restaurant across from the courthouse. And they disagree along the lines that you described in ways that are more than 20% of the valuation that the county gave. And you have a six-month-old appraisal, as you suggest, and that accounts for the difference in property values. What I'm looking at is on line 13, the word may, which is that the judge, under those circumstances, he's looking at your old appraisal and my new appraisal, saying, "Well, that's the difference. I'm not going to award attorney's fees to you, Mr. Lippman, and the Chinese restaurant they'll have to pay for me." Isn't that the most likely scenario when the word in the statute is used as may?
Mr. Clint.
It's not predictable. You don't know what the judge is going to do. Right now, in condemnation cases, example I gave you where the landowner wanted 144 and the jury came back at 31. Under the statute, the judge gave the owner his costs, reimbursement for appraisal fees, his land planner, because he may be able to get those in a jury trial. Even though his claim was not founded, the judge gave him those costs. So I have a feeling that those attorney's fees will be imposed almost any time it's over 20%.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. We still have Marshall Weems and Don Thiessen. I'm sorry, Representative Burnett.
Could I ask Mr.
Clint, I'm sorry. Representative Burnett has an additional question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's on an issue that you raised to Mr. Clint on attorney's fees. Chair Holberg mentioned that the bill lacks some kind of balance and fairness because there should be the ability of the city or government entity to collect when you have the unreasonable holdout person in terms of negotiation. If that were adopted, and I hope Representative Paulson considers that in the future, would that provide the appropriate balance? So you may have at least a mechanism by which you can go after the city that's being unreasonable and then the landowner who's being unreasonable.
Mr. Clark.
And I'm always in favor of more attorney's fees.
You know, when they said that early up in the presentation, I got a little uncomfortable. Mr. Clark.
Right now, the statute provides that even if we are the prevailing party at a jury trial, we cannot get our costs and disbursements, our appraisals, fees, and whatever. My personal feeling from a government entity is that we should bear some costs in this. This is our project. This is for a public purpose. The landowner should have a chance to represent his case. But I think what's trying to be imposed here is that people are trying to make this out as it's always a head-to-head fight between the government and the landowner. In the way we do it, and the way we've encouraged to do it, is to do an open process. We go and we make our offer. We've always provided the landowner at least with the basis of our offer, and now with the appraisal. And if the landowner has something that we missed, we're more than willing to take it into account. To do that balance, I think, presents an enormous risk upon a landowner who may have a point that the government has not considered. Government attorneys may not agree with me, but I don't think that that's a fair risk for a landowner to undertake in a project that was initiated for the benefit of the public.
Thank you, Mr. Clint. Representative Burnett.
Madam Chair, thank you. And on the other issue you raised, which I hope that's checked into further, that the definition of public purpose and the fact that it may be in other parts of the statute, Let me just give you a hypothetical, because I know there's been litigation in other states regarding a sports stadium, whether that has a public purpose. just so as an example, suppose that Anoka puts in a bid to build a sports stadium, and it entails taking away a lot of private land from a lot of different maybe businesses and residents. Does that fit into the definition of public purpose to take land? Representative Lipton says, well, maybe it would be different if the title is owned. So, you know, we may have solved that with the Metrodome by putting that into a commission's a title. But suppose that Anoka wanted to do that and build a stadium, give it to the owners, and take away property. Does that fit public purpose under this new definition?
Mr. Glenn?
I wouldn't know, and there's no definition of it. There's no reference to anything. Right now, there is years of thousands of cases that deal with public purpose in our state, other states, and federal courts that describe what is a public purpose. It may not be always harmonious, but there are decisions that you can look to figure that out. Here we have no background, no basis to go by, and we're leaving it to judges to decide and to interpret with no direction from the legislature. And then you have the further problem of primarily, not just public purpose, but primarily. If you have a mixed use in the stadium where you're going to have the stadium that's turned over, but you're going to have a public park as part of it, or a enhanced wetlands as part of it, that serves a more traditional public purpose. Does that mean that it's less a private taking for that's not it, because you have some other mixed use in there, public and private? It's a very complex issue that I think is not, this should not be addressed in the 117, the process statute, but in a substantive way in the development statutes. If you don't want an EDA or an HRA to take it for those reasons, state so and give the courts clear and clear direction that way.
Thank you, Mr. Clint. We really have to move here because I know that this is a Majority Leader Paulson's favorite committee to come to. So we have two more bills up. Mr. Deason, please keep your comments brief and only on any new issues that have not already been addressed in opposition to this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Don Tyson. I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota County Engineers Association. I'm also the Washington County Engineer. I've formerly been the Dakota County Engineer and Chisago County Engineer. And I've actually sat in farmhouses across from people at dining room tables, negotiated right away to sitting in executive boardrooms with lawyers and discuss this. 17 years of experience with this, I think what you're hearing in this issue is the bell curve. You're hearing extremes on both ends. And the reality is that it works pretty well, as County Attorney from Anoka County has testified in the majority of cases. And the extreme cases you're hearing about really shouldn't be used to set good public policy. I've only been seeing one court trial in my 17 years of experience, and the percentages actually are higher in my experience. We've probably settled 95% of our cases without going through eminent domain process. But I'll also tell you, we have some people that ask us to take them to eminent domain because of tax purposes. They ask us to take it to that. I'll also give you the reality of negotiations when you sit across at a dining room table from somebody and you tell them that, we used to tell them that we had, under full disclosure, we have to pay you for an appraisal, and it's reimbursed with $500. One of the most common responses is, well, why don't you just increase your offer, $500, and we're done. Now, is there public value in that? When I go to my county board and say, we're going to settle this so we don't have to pay an appraisal fee, that's the dilemma we're facing. Is that extortion, or is that public value? I can also tell you, since the law was changed last year, the response is, why don't you just increase your offer $1,500? And we'll settle. I don't think I need to tell you what the next step will be if this bill is passed. Why don't you increase your offer 20% and pay my attorney fees? That's the practical matter of what will happen on the type of takings that are common to the local units of government we're dealing with out there. This process takes time, as the county attorney said. If we have a year old appraisal, similar to like we've done in Wakota Bridge area, acquiring property, we do reappraisals. We go out and get new information and update those. We talk about balancing the playing field. People should recognize that government's given no credit for the increase in land value that happens after the improvement. We're building a new alignment in southern Washington County that's making open vacant farmland now prime for high-density residential development. And we can't take any credit for that improvement that government's making in increasing their land value. There's a lot of discussion about being like the surrounding states, like Wisconsin and South Dakota. Well, that cuts both ways. The first thing then that we need to do is raise the gas tax 10 cents and index it to inflation.
Okay. Finally, you need to round up
your finally, Madam Chair, I'll tell you that as far as horror stories, and I knew I couldn't go anywhere without listening to a story about the Stillwater Bridge, but my last public project I had in northern Washington County, a resident stood up and asked if we were going to have any relocation or condemnation on this county road project. And I said, no, I didn't expect we would. They said, that's a shame because I went through that with MnDOT on Highway 36 and I'd love to go through that process again. So there are stories on both ends.
You bet there. Thank you. Is there a Marshall Weems in the audience? Sir, very briefly, I've got two more bills on the committee agenda and I'm sorry that we ran out of time here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Marshall Weems. I have the pleasure of being the Executive Director of the St. Cloud Housing and Redevelopment Authority, and the mission statement of the St. Cloud HRA is strengthening St. Cloud through housing, economic, and community development. And because of all those things, that's why I'm here today, to let you know of my opposition. Plus, I'm also the Senior Vice President of Minnesota NARO, and we oppose this bill as well. And there's two reasons why we oppose this. The first is that the cost is to the taxpayers. The second is that the would require the state to rewrite all of its acquisition relocation statutes and rules. The first reason opposition, there's no incentive for negotiations. As previous speakers have mentioned, their experience is the same as mine. I rarely end up condemning property. I rarely do it. In fact, in 20 years, I've done it three times. But the way it's written now, attorneys would have a very good reason of going to people and say, hold out, stall it, and you'll make more money, and we'll make more money too. And I don't think that's in the public's interest because it just increases the cost of the project. The delay costs are held by the public sector. In our case, when we're putting together an industrial park, it usually takes a lot of time to put it together, and we have to put it together and have it available for someone to relocate on. And if someone doesn't want to cooperate or doesn't want to let a road be built or doesn't want to let a sewer in there, then we're the ones that are holding the cost and can't get that investment back out. We can't create the tax base or the jobs that we want to have on there. We also have missed opportunity costs. We had one parcel that we just knew we weren't going to be able to get in time, and someone else went to Wisconsin and said, you know, you're not ready, we can't wait for you. We also have no attorneys on our public entity. It's too specialized. We have to pay for it. So the idea that somehow the taxpayer isn't going to pay for it to go after a piece of property that a planning commission, a city council, HRA board all says we ought to be after for the public good still costs the public some money too. And the second reason we're opposed to it is because the acquisition relocation statutes, just by changing one thing, are out of balance. There's no way for the public to the public agencies who are the taxpayers ultimately putting the bill for this can expect it to be fair. We have an incident right now where we do an appraisal when you can't get into a building. So you're estimating really based on public records. If you can't get in there and the person knows that, there's a pretty good chance you're not going to have an accurate appraisal on that. These things are very important to us. If this bill had been in place a year ago, we believe that we would have lost a major employer in St. Cloud because they were being relocated, strangely enough, for a public purpose project, a road being widened, losing all their parking. There's 350 employees in St. Cloud, 3,000 nationwide. They're one of our biggest employers, but they only have 4% of their business in Minnesota. They could just as easily dispatch the barges and ships from somewhere else as St. Cloud, but they have to move because the road's taking their place. So we had a piece of property. We thought it was big enough. MnDOT did a development agreement with them. MnDOT came and said, we need a piece of that for the road. The site got too small. We had adjacent property we bought. It was still too small. So we went back to someone who was adjacent property who had said to us, why don't you buy us last year? And we said, okay, we'll buy you now. He wants triple the appraised value of the property and is delaying us. In court, he said he paid $9,000. For a consultant to tell us he has a nice house. We knew he had a nice house. That's why we were willing to pay him fair market value for that.
But the cases we're talking about now still means the taxpayers are going to pay for this if it goes on.
Right,
so we just don't know how that it's fair to or we're going to be able to carry out our public purpose if we don't have the ability to know what our costs are going to be.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank
I'm sorry that we were short on time. Are there any additional questions for the bill author at this time? Representative Adkins.
And I will be very brief. I've sat on this since the beginning. It echoes what Representative Lippman brought up. It's for the author, and that was on line 13. Or perhaps it's for the proponent, Ms. Schlander, but why may and not shall? And I assume that was chosen on purpose so that there would be discretion for the fact finder, the judge, whoever it may be. My suggestion would be that, because I like the thought behind it, Mr. Majority Leader, which is standing up for the little guy. If we set forth the standard for the fact finder, for the judge to follow, we may address many of the issues that have been raised, because I think we are only solely looking at those situations where we've seen somewhat of a bad faith on the part of the condemning authority. Where we're trying to stick it to them, where we've had people testify that it's not, we don't go out seeking a lowball offer, and that perhaps is what we're trying to get at. I don't mean to put words in the majority leader's mouth as often as I may try, but I think that may be what we're trying to get at, is those really egregious situations that fall under, was it the county engineer talked about the bell curve. Maybe there's certain egregious ones that need addressing. I'd be happy to. My thought is to pass it out of the committee. I'd be happy to try to work with you on finding that operative language and see if we can accommodate what everybody's got in mind.
Members, if I might summarize, I'd like to move this bill to the next committee. I'm going to support moving it to Transportation Finance. I think that there are some issues of balance both ways of the definition of primary public purpose, some things that can be addressed. The majority leader, I know, is more than willing to work with the opponents and proponents to look at narrowing down to those instances where we have the major problem. Once that language is settled on, then we should be able to address the fiscal issues. I know MnDOT's in the room. They didn't want to testify, but they're definitely monitoring this bill as well, and I know Representative Queasley is very concerned about that issue as well. So if no other comments, I would move that House File 1901 as amended be moved to Transportation Finance without recommendation. Any questions on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay.
Nay.
The motion passes. The only way to Transportation Finance, and I think that if you'll continue to work with the committee members that express concerns and those in the audience that express concerns with the bill, we would certainly appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Smith.
Yes. Members, at the last committee meeting, I announced at the beginning of the meeting, and some of you weren't here, so now I'm going to try the middle of the meeting while most of you are here. Each of you have a red save file in your folders after today's meeting. If your materials are not in your red save file, we will be, actually Alicia will be throwing this stuff away. So it's your last warning. Representative Smith.
Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'd like since I'm a member of the committee, I'd like to...
Members, if you could take the conversation out of the room, we would appreciate it. Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, House File 1944, I'd like to move the bill. It would be recommended to pass and move to the House floor. Also, I do have an amendment in order to get the bill in the shape that I would like.
All righty.
And it's Amendment AO4-0849, dealing with...
Move that at the time to get the bill in the shape the author would like to discuss it. Members, this is just an enactment date. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Your bill is amended.
All right, Madam Chair, in brief, we do have a witness or two who are victims and who will testify as to the need for this bill. Very briefly, House File 1944 is a small step in adding additional personal safety for victims of violent crimes when their attackers are being or about to be released into the public. The bill seeks to protect in that regard. Under current law, protection orders may be extended for three reasons: violation of a past order, fear of physical harm, or actual acts of harassment or stalking. However, the courts are limited in their ability to extend or grant a new order when a person is about to be released or has been released. In the past, many victims have sought to protect themselves by making a proper application for an OFP when they become aware of the impending release, only to see their petitions denied by the court. Court lacks authority to grant or extend an OFP during the perpetrator's incarceration because the victim can't establish the facts necessary under the law. This bill corrects that by allowing an order to be granted or extended upon the planned or actual release of the perpetrator. That's it in a nutshell.
Thank you. Representative Smith, I see that you have two people on the list to testify, Vanessa Ray and Mr. Carlson. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record, please.
Vanessa Ray.
If you'd like to continue.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, hello. My name is Vanessa Ray. I'm from Echo, Minnesota. I'm a continuing client that works with the RAP program of Yellow Medicine County. I'm here to testify on behalf of the bill that is presented to you that extends or renews OFPs when the perpetrator is incarcerated or about to be released from prison. I have personally experienced the frustration of dealing with this issue. I was under the impression that my OFP was good for 2 years. About 2 weeks before he was to be released, it was brought to my attention that my OFP was no longer in effect. Due to the fact he was in prison for that year, I was unable to extend my order because there was no contact while he was locked up. But due to the fear of the past violence of abuse and behaviors, I was very fearful that he would come after me and make me pay for him sitting in prison. I had a difficult time of getting the order renewed. I'm here to ask you not to put other women through such a hard time when they are fearful already. Since his release, he has made contact and violated the current order against him. When he made his contact, he was only out about 24 hours. It's hard enough to hold him accountable for his actions when he knows how to play the system and get away with it, especially when release conditions are not enforced by the police. Please vote to pass this bill to protect other women. Thank you.
Ms. Ray, thank you for coming to share your story. Is there anybody that has a question for
Madam Chair
at this time?
I have not asked for any witnesses from either the county attorney's office or law enforcement. I have checked with the lobbyist for a couple of those groups. I'm not aware of any of their opposition. This bill is not only supported but proposed by the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. And if there are any questions legally, that's why Mr. Carlson is here to answer those.
Hey, Mr. Carlson, did you have anything you wanted to add at this time?
Madam Chairman and members, Joel Carlson, I'm here as a volunteer on behalf of the Coalition of Battered Women, and also I'm a board member of the Rivers of Hope, which is a domestic abuse advocacy program that works with victims like Vanessa. I'd be happy to answer any questions that maybe she may have about the problem. We can't meet the conditions. This change will allow those orders to go into effect. And there are significant legal consequences for violating an OFP. They'll get notice of it, they'll know what those consequences are, and hopefully.
Thank you. And Representative Smith, it's my understanding that you've also talked with the Department of Corrections and they have no problems with this.
Chair, that is correct.
So, Representative Littman, did you have a question?
Forgive me, are we on 1944 or 1945?
44.
Okay, I do have a question. Chairman Holberg, Representative Smith, I guess how does this work? Is it a tolling provision such that the length of the order can be longer, or would Ms. Ray have to go back to court to get an extension? How does that operate?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chairman and Representative Lippman, orders for protection are usually granted for a set period of time, typically 1 year and in some cases 2 years. The court can extend that order not for an indefinite period of time, but for a set period of time. And if your order expires while the perpetrator is incarcerated, you're unable to meet the conditions, and that's why the bill is here. But they don't grant a lifetime ban. It's not key rows. If you need to have additional orders granted, you need to make a proper application, proper notice, and you need to establish harm or fear of physical harm.
Thank you. Representative Lippman.
Chairman Holberg, Mr. Carlson, just so I understand, so the person as to which Ms. Ray had an order of protection was in prison, so she wasn't eligible to ask for re-upping because he was in prison. He wasn't, in a sense, a present threat because he was in state custody. But as soon as he is released, he's going to be a present threat again. And so this would broaden the criteria, so it wouldn't be a disqualification. Do I have it right?
Correct.
Mr. Carlson.
Great, thanks.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Representative Pugh.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith. Is the maximum time you can obtain an order 2 years? Is that set by statute?
Mr. Carlson, Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative Pugh, the answer is yes.
Representative Pugh.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, would another possible approach would be to extend, by statute, say it could be 5 years or something like that? That would exceed normal incarceration terms. But.
Representative Smith. Or Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chairman and Representative Pugh, we haven't found a particular problem with the length of the existing OFPs and how that relates to sentencing. I don't think that we need to have that. I also think that courts are reluctant to enter into those types of long-term agreements where you have custody issues involved. And dissolution issues. So I think that the time frame is adequate. It is only in the limited circumstances where your OFP expires when the perpetrator's incarcerated, where you can't meet the conditions for an extension.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Representative Smith, would you like to renew your motion? Oh, I'm sorry. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak in opposition to this bill?
Renew my motion then that House File 1944, as amended, be recommended to pass, be moved to the House General Register.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion is adopted. Thank you very much, Ms. Ray, Mr. Carlson, and Representative Smith. You're up again here with House File 1945.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House File 1945 is another protection in the same area that was proposed by the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. Also, the same checking done on the previous bill was done on this bill. Briefly,
And just if I might interrupt, yes, just a second, members, this bill will be heard today and they'll be held over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Data Practices Act.
That's my motion. Thank you, Madam Chair. this bill, basically what it does is it adds both a victim of domestic abuse and the victim's attorney to the list of individuals who are permitted to receive police reports at no cost. Several years ago, very briefly, this legislature required the collection of specific data on domestic abuse allegations. In 1998, we amended the law to allow the release of the data upon request to designated advocates for the victims, but not to the victims themselves. For a couple of reasons, we're asking for this change. Many times a victim needs the information to obtain orders for protection. that can be granted ex parte without meeting threshold requirements that may be contained in the requested reports. Also, in some cases, it is more difficult these days to find an advocate, fewer and fewer perhaps. Therefore, it is more critical that this data be in the hands of the victim and or the victim's attorney.
Thank you. Are there any questions of the bill author at this time? Would you like to move your amendment for your enactment date?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the amendment, AO4-0848, making the effective date final upon enactment.
All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion is adopted. Your bill has been amended with an enactment date. I do have Ms. Ray, Mr. Carlson, and Ms. Baylor listed as people who would like to testify in support of this.
Madam Chair, only to the extent that there are questions about the need for the
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions at this time? Is there anybody else in the audience that would like to address this issue? Gee, we could have spent more time on eminent domain.
Then they don't.
Representative Cole.
I wouldn't want to get out of here, I guess, without asking one more question. I see that Mr. Gemberling is here. I don't know. Has the department taken a position on this? Do they have any problems with it? I don't know that I want to necessarily open a can of worms here. And if I am, maybe we can hold that question until we reconsider the bill. But if there's a simple yes or no, I'd be interested in knowing that.
Mr. Gemberling, I think the question is did you review? And I'm sorry we're making you come to the stand, but I think Representative Coles would like to know if you reviewed the language and if you have any problems with it.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. A slight indulgence.
Always.
I just want to thank you for welcoming me to my 30th legislative session.
Oh, my goodness.
Madam Chair, Representative Cole, typically we don't look at bills that make a policy judgment on them. We look at them for technical things. If we see something that kind of raises a red flag based on what you've done historically, we probably mention that to somebody, but we don't see our role as acting as a gatekeeper about bills. Mr. Carlson showed me this bill. It kind of follows on something that was done, I believe, as Representative Smith indicated, in 1998, and it kind of closes the loop, and that, you know, that seems to make some sense.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any additional questions?
Representative
Smith.
We have nothing further to present. I just wanted to point out that there are other persons in the room who have similar stories that are here and cared enough to come to be prepared to testify, but also have observed this committee, and are very appreciative of your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anybody in the audience that wants to speak in opposition to House File 1945? All right. Representative Smith renews his motion that House File 1945 be held over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Data Practices Act. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. We will see this again later on some really fun day where we're going to put the big data practices bill together. So thank you very much. Any other questions, members? All right. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. Meeting adjourned.